Today, we seemingly take many things for granted, never giving a thought to what our ancestors went through over 100 years ago. Going to and from work using our cars as well as other means of transport, to carrying out our daily duties within our workplace, which is reminiscent of scenes from Groundhog Day in that each working day is just like the last. But sometimes we may need the help of professionals to help us achieve a relatively normal way of life, and again, we take doctors, nurses, the ambulance services, the police as well as other emergency response officers for granted, expecting them to be just a phone call away. However, Victorian England was completely different, and for this next story we'll be uncovering the disturbing reality of childbirth in the 1800s. And as medical science was still pretty much in its infancy in the mid to late 1800s, childbirth was still an agonising and perilous thing for any woman to have gone through. Painkillers were non-existent, with the exception of opium, and even this was rarely used. Cleanliness and hygiene were still a thing yet to be linked with infections and other causes of illnesses, not just towards the mother of a newborn baby, but also to the baby itself. And as many babies had suffered from poor health days and weeks, even months after being born. But the medical side of things was only a small part of the wider issues that women had to face whilst giving birth. Now it seems that during the Victorian age, a woman had to suffer in silence, regardless of the pain they would go through during childbirth. And it was generally accepted that they just had to suffer for their sins, as was the terminology used over 100 years ago. Most women had to give birth within their own homes, and to do so they would, for obvious reasons, need help of others. This help usually came in the form of family or friends, with some women practicing as midwives, even though they had never undertaken any formal training. In fact, trained doctors would only be used as a last resort, and when there was a significant risk of death to either the mother or the baby. And it's the doctors and their assistants that would, at times, prove to be the main carriers of infection, often using tools that hadn't been cleaned from previous use on other people. So this brings us to our next story, and that of 38-year-old Elizabeth Spencer. On the morning of Tuesday, 16th of June, 1885, Lewis Spencer, wagon inspector for the Midlands Railway Company, was getting ready to leave for work at around 5:45 a.m. Having checked in on his wife Elizabeth, who was lying in bed, he leant over to give her a kiss on the forehead, telling her he would soon be back home and that all would be okay. Confined to her bed, Elizabeth was preparing for the birth of their fourth child, after already having three children, with the youngest being just 18 months old. Now helping the Spencers was Mrs. Mary Irving, who resided at nearby Muncaster Place. Aged 78 years old, Mary had spent most of her adult life working as a midwife, helping the most vulnerable of women whilst in their confinements. But just like many other midwives at this time, she had never undertaken any training prior to taking on any work. However, it seems that Elizabeth had trusted Mary as she had helped deliver one of her children only a couple of years previously. Also, Elizabeth would never entertain the idea of calling on a doctor when the time had come to deliver her baby. So Mary had arrived at the Spencer's home early in the morning and duly began preparations for the birth of Elizabeth's child. She had placed towels on a table in the bedroom and had already given instructions to a younger girl by the name of Sarah Jane McGee to watch over Elizabeth's three other children while she was busy attending to Elizabeth. At 7:45 a.m, Lewis returned home for his breakfast. He found Elizabeth lying in bed with Mary also in the room. It was obvious that Elizabeth was in pain, but he simply put this down to the effects of childbirth. He asked both Elizabeth and Mary if he could help in any way, but Mary assured him all was fine and soon thereafter he would later leave and return back to work. By around 8:30 in the morning, Elizabeth was in a lot more discomfort, so Mary asked Sarah to go to where Lewis worked to ask if he would purchase some spirits. He duly obliged, spending a shilling's worth on whiskey and another shilling's worth of brandy, to which he passed over to Sarah so she could take it back to Mary. Now back at the Spencer's home, Sarah placed the spirits onto a mantelpiece in the bedroom, and it wasn't too long after that Mary would pour a small amount of brandy into a glass to give to Elizabeth. By 11 o'clock, Lewis would again return home, this time for lunch, and after going to see his wife, she replied saying she was about the same, and there was no danger. Lewis asked her if he should bring someone to help, but Elizabeth would still object to seeking out a doctor. As the afternoon wore on, it was becoming more and more obvious that Elizabeth was struggling whilst in labour. The pain was intensifying, but despite this, she would still refuse the help of a doctor. What would transpire over the course of the next 15 minutes though would be truly horrifying. It seems that Elizabeth had struggled to give birth to her baby and things had escalated beyond reasonable control. Just after 2 o'clock that afternoon, Sarah McGee was summoned into the bedroom, When she entered, she noticed Mary had both of her hands hidden underneath the bedclothes. "Fetch me a cloth," Mary instructed Sarah. Sarah obliged, passing Mary one of several cloths that had been placed alongside a table opposite the bed. After doing so, Sarah left the bedroom but returned minutes later. Mary by this time had wrapped something in the cloth and passed it over to Sarah. Now a few seconds passed, but it was long enough for Sarah just to realise what had been wrapped inside the cloth. She knew all right, but she still wanted clarification. "What is it?" she asked Mary. Mary looked at Sarah but said nothing. Instead, she just nodded. Not quite sure what to do with the wrapped up item, Sarah placed it inside a tin box that was in the bedroom. A few moments passed and Mrs. Lawson, who was another neighbour, came into the house and up to the bedroom. When she entered the room, Mary was trying to calm Elizabeth down. Sarah, who was still in shock at the scenes that were unfolding in front of her eyes, overheard Elizabeth begging with Mary. "Don't touch me. I am that sore, I can bide no more," pleaded Elizabeth. "I won't let her touch you," Mrs. Lawson replied to Elizabeth. Sarah also overheard Mary saying, "I wish it was over, because we might have had a jig by now." Mrs. Lawson had been in and out of the Spencer's house throughout much of the day, seeing how Elizabeth was doing and trying to help out where she could. Her first visit was around 9 or 10 that morning, and Elizabeth seemed in a lot of pain. At around 4 o'clock, Mrs. Lawson saw Elizabeth struggling and she would plead with her to let a doctor come to see her, but Elizabeth replied yet again saying, "Doctors do me no good." Mrs. Anna Livingstone, another neighbour, would also visit Elizabeth later that afternoon to offer some help. She would also go on to notice that Elizabeth's health had taken a turn for the worse and thought it best to let her husband know that things didn't seem right. She would therefore make her way to the works where Lewis was employed, and after a short time of searching for him, she found him walking along a railway platform. She asked him if he would be going home for tea and that Elizabeth hadn't seen as well as she had been earlier on in the day. So Lewis immediately left work and returned home at around 4:20 p.m. In the bedroom he saw Elizabeth and it was instantly obvious to him that she was in much pain. She asked him if anybody had been for him, to which he replied yes. He then asked both Elizabeth and Mary if he should go for a doctor, but both told him there was no necessity for him to do so, as well as it being wrong that Mrs. Livingstone had called for him in the first place. Now obviously, Lewis was worried about how things were developing and in seeing how much pain his wife, Elizabeth, was suffering with. But thinking this was perhaps a normal scenario and as nature intended, he would yet again return back to work shortly after. At 6 o'clock, Lewis returned home, but no sooner had he entered his house, Mrs. Lawson met him at the door. She would ask Lewis if he knew how Elizabeth was and both of them would make their way upstairs and into the bedroom. Mrs. Lawson would head up the stairs before Lewis, but she stopped and turned around to him just before they both entered the bedroom. "She must be taking the wrong way," Mrs. Lawson softly spoke to Lewis. And upon entering the room, we can only speculate on what proceeded from then on, as both Mrs. Lawson and Lewis would spend the next hour or so trying to comfort poor Elizabeth. And at this time, it seems neither of them were aware of the incident that had taken place only a few hours prior, with Sarah placing an item wrapped in a cloth inside a tin box. But at around 7:30 in the evening, Mrs. Lawson began to see a change in Elizabeth, and concerned over her welfare, Mrs. Lawson demanded that Lewis go and fetch a doctor. Obviously worried, Lewis made his way to the home of Dr. Frederick Abbott. After explaining the situation taking place at his home at Sunnyside Terrace, Dr. Abbott hurriedly made his way over to in his car, leaving Lewis to run back on his own. Arriving at the Spencer's home, Dr. Abbott immediately made his way upstairs and into the bedroom. Upon entering, he saw Elizabeth gasping for breath. "She is dying. Who is the nurse?" he asked. Elizabeth then asked if she may have a drink, so Mrs. Lawson made her way down to make a cup of tea, as all of the brandy had by now been drank and there was very little whiskey left. Seeing the pain Elizabeth was in, Dr. Abbott quickly helped deliver her baby, which would unfortunately be dead upon arrival. He would also be horrified at the sight in front of him. The child had its left arm torn away from the shoulder. "What have you let this woman lie in this state for until she is nearly dead?" Dr. Abbott asked Mary. "And where is the arm?" he demanded to know, but got no response from her. "It's a queer thing where this arm is. I must know," he would continue to press Mary. Laying the baby down alongside poor Elizabeth, Dr. Abbott proceeded to check around the room until he had found the arm, which was still wrapped up in the cloth Sarah McGee had given to Mary. "And what is this?" he asked, to which Mary replied, "I don't know." "You don't know what a thing is with four fingers and a thumb," he replied back. "This is disgraceful neglect." When Mrs. Lawson arrived back upstairs with the tea, Dr. Abbott held the baby up and faced Mrs. Lawson. "Look, what a fine child, but it is quite dead and with its arm torn off," he would go on to say. "Do you know anything about this?" Meanwhile, Lewis had made his way home and was stood at the bottom of the staircase. He overheard Dr. Abbott talking to Mary, saying how it was a very bad job and, he could not think of what they had been doing to let the woman get into such a bad state. 10 minutes would pass and Lewis never once heard Mary speak or try to explain what had occurred. Finally, Dr. Abbott left the bedroom and made his way downstairs. Pausing at the bottom, he looked at Lewis and in a soft tone of voice said to him that he should go upstairs to his wife and that the case was a very bad one and that his wife was dying. He should go up to her and bid her goodbye. "If you have anything to say to her, you had better be quick," he would tell Lewis. In complete shock, Lewis asked Dr. Abbott, "Is there no chance?" To which he replied, "No. The way she is torn, it is a physical impossibility for her to live. Your place is upstairs with your wife. You had better go upstairs now and bid her goodbye." Making his way into the bedroom, Lewis sat at the side of his wife who was still conscious. "I think I am done," would be Elizabeth's last words to Lewis. Dr. Abbott left Lewis to be alone with his wife and would return 3/4 of an hour later. By this time, Elizabeth had sadly passed away. In the bedroom were Mrs. Lawson and Mary, and this seemed to infuriate Dr. Abbott. Shouting at both of them, he warned the two women against saying anything, as the case would most likely lead to an inquiry. News soon spread and several people whom had known both Lewis and Elizabeth arrived to pay their respects. Amongst them was Mrs. Livingstone and a lady by the name of Mrs. Taylor. The following day, at around 12 noon, Lewis visited Dr. Abbott to sort out the paperwork for Elizabeth's death and to pick up a death certificate. Dr. Abbott was unavailable at the time, so Lewis would return at around 6 p.m. later that evening. After handing over the required documents, Dr. Abbott would tell Lewis that he would have to report the case and that she, Mrs. Irving, should be punished. But it seems that Lewis had taken this to mean that Dr. Abbott had already reported Mary Irving to the city coroner. Lewis would then proceed to call on Mr. Beryl, registrar, who would in turn issue a certificate of burial, which would see both Elizabeth and her baby both being buried on the following Thursday. 2 days later, and by Thursday, 18th of June, news of the death of Elizabeth, as well as the trauma and subsequent death of the baby, had reached the chief constable. Horrified at what he had heard, he managed to send a telegram to Mr. J. Hewitson Brown, the city coroner, who was over in Cockermouth, but on business. The chief constable also dispatched a messenger to stop the funeral from taking place, and as he arrived at the home of Lewis, the hearse had already arrived and was awaiting the loading of the coffin. Relatives and friends had by this time gathered to pay their final respects. Now, it goes without saying that the funeral would not take place that day, with the hearse being sent back into town. This in turn led to more excitement in the district, resulting in more pain and anguish for Lewis and his 3 children. The city coroner instructed police surgeons Dr. Walker and Dr. Ledyard to perform a post-mortem, with Dr. Abbott being present if he chose to do so. The post-mortem of the body of Elizabeth would take place later that same afternoon, and an inquest would take place later in the evening at the Golden Fleece Inn, St. Nicholas, and would be held by Mr. Brown, the city coroner. Now, the inquest wouldn't last too long, with Mr. Brown telling those who were sworn in as jury members that due to the late hour he would propose that after sufficient formal evidence of identity of the body was made, they resumed the inquest the following day at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and within the West Walls Police Office. The jury then went to view the body, and on their return, Lewis would be called to confirm the identity of the body of that of his wife, Elizabeth. Mr. Brown, satisfied that the identity had been made, would leave an order for the burial of Elizabeth to take place. The resumed inquest would take place the next day, Friday, 19th of June, and it would be Lewis Spencer who would be first to take to the stand. He would tell the jury of what transpired on the day of his wife's death, and how he had left for work in the morning, only to return throughout the day whilst on his breaks. He would also tell of how he had purchased 2 bottles of spirits and given them to Sarah McGee on the request of Mary Irving, and this would seem to raise 1 or 2 eyebrows from the city coroner, Mr. Brown. "At the different interviews you had with Mrs. Irving, was she sober?" Mr. Brown asked Lewis. "According to what I could see, she was. She was never on her legs when I went upstairs. She sat beside the bed all the time I was present," he would reply. In fact, it seems that the coroner, as well as the foreman of the jury, would keep pushing Lewis on whether or not Mary had been drunk whilst trying to help Elizabeth. None of the women who were present made any suggestion as to Mrs. Irving being the worse for drink, and neither did Mr. Abbott. Lewis replied saying, "I never inquired what became of the drink that came into my house." Sarah McGee would also be called before the jury, and she wept and sobbed so much whilst under examination it became almost too difficult to understand what she was saying. However, and just as they did with Lewis, they would question Sarah over the 2 bottles of spirits that she had brought back with her after going to see Lewis at his place of work. "Did you notice whether all of the spirits had gone?" asked Mr. Brown. "One of the bottles was empty, and the other almost empty. I heard Mrs. Irving saying, I wish it was over because we might have had a jig by now. So it was becoming clearly obvious by now that the city coroner and the jury were trying their very best to insinuate that Mary was possibly drunk whilst trying to attend to Elizabeth. Dr. Abbott would be called before the jury, and talk would soon lead to how the death certificate was issued. It seems that the day after the death of Elizabeth, after Lewis had made his way over to Dr. Abbott's premises, a certificate would not at first be issued until he had spoken with Mr. Burrell, the registrar. After informing Mr. Burrell of the events that had taken place the previous day, Dr. Abbott was told that the only certificate he could be given was one that Elizabeth had died from the shock of confinement. Mr. Burrell would also mention to Dr. Abbott that he could see no reason why an inquiry would be needed and that the details on the certificate would be sufficient. Dr. Abbott would go on to read an extract from the instructions given to medical men by the Registrar General. In all cases of deaths from violence or suspected violence, the medical practitioner should inform the friends of the deceased that it is their duty to bring the case to the knowledge of the coroner in order that he may decide as to holding or not an inquest, and that, should they neglect to do this, the coroner may feel it is his duty, when the case comes to knowledge, to order the body to be exhumed and an inquiry instituted. This led to a feisty response from the city coroner, Mr. Brown. You would hardly wish us to understand that if the arm of the child was torn off, no violence was used? No violence was used towards the mother, replied Dr. Abbott. But not happy with this reply, Mr. Brown was curious as to why Dr. Abbott failed to inform the police, saying, Did it not occur to you, having regard to the serious nature of the case, it would have been better to have informed the chief constable? Dr. Abbott replied, I did not know who he was, and I didn't know the coroner. I should have informed them, but the information given in the instructions of the Registrar General. Dr. Abbott would then also be questioned by a jury member, who asked him, Do you think if Mrs. Irving had sent for a doctor sooner, the child might have been saved, and the mother also? Certainly, replied Dr. Abbott. Then, by not sending for a doctor, both the child and mother are dead by neglect. Now, strangely, Dr. Abbott found this last question somewhat amusing, and replied in a mocking tone, What answer should I give to that? Next up came Dr. Ledyard, as well as Dr. Walker, both of whom had performed the post-mortem on Elizabeth. They had prepared a joint report which described the appearances presented by the internal organs of the deceased, and state that the cause of death was hemorrhage resulting from rupture. Dr. Ledyard also added by saying that the efforts to deliver the child, great violence had been inflicted not only upon the child, but also upon the mother, violence resulting in laceration such as described in the report. In this case, it seems that an early intervention by a skilled medical man, i.e. a doctor, would have saved the life of the woman, and the child would probably have been born alive. In summing up, Mr. Brown, City Coroner, would say that it was now up to the jury to consider whether the evidence given was enough to find Mrs. Mary Irving guilty of carelessness or unskillfulness. He would remind them that the law required such duties to be undertaken with a reasonable amount of knowledge and skillfulness, and if there was an absence of such, then a verdict of guilty by neglect must be given, and if such a verdict was agreed upon, then Mrs. Irving must go to trial on the charge of manslaughter. The jury didn't take long to consider the charges, and after some consideration they returned a verdict of manslaughter against Mrs. Irving. The foreman of the jury also added, The jury are also of opinion that the conduct of Mr. Abbott in giving a certificate as the cause of death without first informing the proper authorities is deserving of the severest censure. On Monday, 22nd of June, Mary would appear before the Mayor, J.R. Crichton, at the Town Hall, charged with feloniously killing Elizabeth Spencer on the 16th of June, 1885. Mr. Errington for the prosecution would detail the circumstances of the case, and he would also bring into question as to if Mary was drunk or under the influence of drink when trying to deliver Elizabeth's baby. He spoke of the two bottles of spirits that Sarah McGee had brought back into the house with her after being sent out to fetch them by Mary, and how one of them was empty and the other nearly empty by the time Lewis Spencer arrived back home later that evening. He would tell the bench that he could satisfy them that Mary was indeed drunk, and would ask them to come to the conclusion that the injuries inflicted upon Elizabeth were occasioned by gross and criminal negligence. The bench, satisfied that a case should be brought before Mary, would commit her for trial at the Cumberland Assizes. On Thursday, the 2nd of July, the trial of Mary Irving would take place at the Cumberland Assizes, Carlisle. All of the evidence we have already discussed would be mentioned, and in closing, Mr. Shee, defending Mary, would tell the jury that age in itself is no evidence of negligence, although no doubt it may have been prudent for Mary to have perhaps given up the business she had worked in much earlier in her life. Now, although Mary was nearly 80 years of age and undoubtedly infirm, and although shaky, she was perfectly justified in accepting the employment from Elizabeth Spencer. He would argue that despite being asked on many occasions, Elizabeth and Louis Spencer had both turned down the use of a doctor, and like many sensible people in the country, they preferred a midwife to a doctor. Mr. Shee would also tell the court that Mary had probably spent her whole life in that line of work, and in this case, she did the very best, despite her age and how shaky she may have been. He would end by saying that the mischief was due to an error of judgment, and therefore Mrs. Irving was not responsible. In summing up, Mr. Justice Manister asked the jury not to allow their feelings to be carried away by sympathy for an aged woman. The question was not whether Mary did her best, but whether she brought to bear upon her practice of midwifery a reasonable amount of skill. He would tell the jury that the real mischief was done when Mary tore away the arm of the child, saying it was an undeniable fact that violence was used. And as to the plea that Mary was old and infirm, her age would not excuse her undertaking a job that she was not reasonable, competent to undertake. The jury retired, and when they arrived back in court just after 2 o'clock, they returned a verdict of guilty. In passing sentence, Mr. Justice Manister said he believed that in finding Mary guilty, the jury had done their duty. However, he would take into account Mary's age and infirmity, as well as the fact that she had worked as a midwife for most of her life. It was a case, he said, he wished to be very lenient, and he would pass a sentence which would be almost nominal, but others must know that it was wrong to undertake a duty for which they were incompetent. The object of the sentence was therefore not so much to punish Mary, but to serve as a warning to others. Mary would therefore be sentenced to just 1 month's imprisonment without hard labour. However, this wasn't going to be the end. And less than a week after being sentenced, the Home Secretary would, after representations being made on behalf of Mary, send an order for her release, simply saying that she was unfit to suffer imprisonment. So thank you very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this story. It's a sad one, and there's a lot that goes on in this story, from negligence to possibly being drunk whilst trying to help a lady who's giving birth, to a kind of cover-up, you could say, from Dr. Abbott, who didn't follow protocol by reporting it to the chief constable. I'd love to hear your comments down below, or read your comments down below. But if you did enjoy this story and you want to know more, please show some support. Like I said, comment down below. You can also follow me on Twitter and on Instagram, as well as YouTube. Links, again, are also down below. But in the meantime, take care, and I will be back soon with another tale from the past.